Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. We're happy to be back and kicking things off for the new year with our first guests. I'm happy to introduce our speaker today, Richard Simmons, the portfolio manager of Derby Street. Richard was an undergraduate at Oxford University and also has an MBA. He was a banker for 11 years and wrote a book about Warren Buffett before becoming an investment manager in 2001. The two Derby Street funds were launched in 2013 and are both investing long-only in equities, one in the UK and the other in Europe. As always, for those of you joining us, please feel free to post your questions and comments in the live chat throughout the presentation, and we'll try and answer those throughout. If not, we'll go ahead and hit on all of those once we get to the Q&A at the end of things. And without further ado, we'll go ahead and hand things over to Richard, and we can jump into some more background on Derby and kind of some of their history and what they do on a daily basis.
Hi, well, thank you very much, Graham, for this opportunity. I really appreciate it, and thank you to Guru Focus. I had a fairly... let me just go ahead and share that screen. I had a fairly unconventional entry into investment management. I was a banker, first of all. There's a few details of my CV up there on the screen. So my core skill was really credit analysis. I was looking at business plans. I saw hundreds and hundreds of them. I met hundreds of businesses, I suppose, over my 11 or so years in banking. I learned about lots of industries. Some industries I found were really very difficult for the owners to make money from, businesses that were very dependent on much larger customers, like food suppliers, for example, toy suppliers, and other businesses that were retail-focused, retailers themselves, hotels, restaurants, tended to have low barriers to entry, very high operating leverage. Obviously, we've seen some of the consequences of that in this pandemic. You could identify them fairly readily, tended to have low returns on capital, usually dependent on debt. And those are the businesses that it was difficult for us as lenders to make money from, and I think as shareholders as well. So after that, investing had really taken off as a personal interest. I started to read, like so many people, I guess, that you speak to, Graham, I suppose, started to read more Warren Buffett. I got completely engrossed in his work and his writings, and I ended up writing a book in the late 90s, which was really my attempt to reverse engineer, work out from his examples what he'd been thinking, but a little bit more mathematically. That book was published. It was called Buffett Step by Step. By this stage, I was investing a little bit of my own money. A friend had given me some money to invest, and I developed a genuine passion myself for investing. And I went ahead, became regulated in 2001. And that's when I started managing money in managed accounts. And they did pretty well. There was quite a lot of outperformance. And so we went ahead and set up a couple of funds, the Derby Street funds, one UK equities and one in European equities. And they launched in 2013. And I put up there a slide showing the cumulative performance and the more recent performance. We've had, as it happens, an absolutely cracking fourth quarter for reasons partly due to the announcement of the vaccines, but I think largely just the things that we managed to pick up very, very cheaply, particularly early last year, I should say. happened all to come together in a whole spate of outperformance. So you'll see there very big performances for the quarter. But if you look at the two more important or interesting numbers, the inception numbers, you'll see since 2013, the UK stock market essentially has been flat. That's that 2% number. Whereas our fund is up 60%. And in Europe, the index is up. There's the last line on that slide, but we're up about 100% more. So that's the history of the fund.
Definitely. And now, if you wouldn't mind, could we dive into some of the investment strategy and process that y'all are employing kind of on a day-to-day basis? How do you really get in there in the nitty-gritty and figure out where to invest that money?
Sure. The strategy is value. Value is a word you hear all the time. Not all funds are value funds, of course. Actually, these days, the bulk of money is in index funds, so they're sort of almost anti-value if you're putting your money in index funds. But that's a good set of competitors for us to have. But more particularly, since value is used to mean different things, we are what we call modern value investors. And I can contrast this with what a lot of people call value. What a lot of people call value is relative value. A high dividend yield, a low PE, a low price to book. You know, that can work, but it's become less and less successful for various reasons. But essentially, it tends to point you towards lower quality businesses. Modern value really is getting back to a very basic idea that's probably 100 years old, that value is simply buying a security that is trading for less than the present day value of its future cash flows. And that sounds obvious as well, but really, if you think about it, that's quite separate from looking at historic numbers like price earnings on its own or dividend yield on its own. We're really purely interested in the future of the business. The past is an important clue, but it doesn't tell us what the future is going to be. And I can talk a bit more about, you know, our valuation process later, if you like, if there are any questions on that. But to move on to more, you know, specifics and to put flesh on the bones a little bit about how we do it in practice, we've divided our portfolio into three types of value opportunity, all of which are sub branches of this modern value investing idea. And I've started with the most interesting one because it's unusual. Not many funds are doing it. It's something that we turned over probably 14 years ago or so during the Lehman crisis, where we found a lot of businesses, particularly investment trusts, that were trading at big discounts to their net asset value, but they were also in a position where they could be wound up very easily. So liquidations, we call them. These are not bankruptcies. These are solvent companies that are quoted, have a stock market quotation, that have decided, or quite often, more often, someone has decided for them that they shouldn't be in business anymore. And so they put together a strategy for selling the assets and returning the cash to shareholders, usually in a fairly tax-efficient way. And we've invested in 15 or 16 of these. And where it works out, it's been exceptionally profitable. Where it doesn't work out, we don't tend to lose money. We tend to just get our capital back. So that's been a nice high value source of alpha for us. There don't tend to be that many around at any one time, so unfortunately it's not the biggest part of the portfolio. The second strategy I've identified there I've called discounted assets, but it also includes something that I call hidden assets or hidden value. But the simplest example would be a property company that's not liquidating, that's just carrying on, where we're able to buy a very substantial discount to our estimate of realizable value. And that's often over 50% discount. And if the net asset value per share keeps on growing, It tends to. Then we make money in two ways. First, as the net asset value goes up. And secondly, as the discount closes. So that's a simple example. But the hidden asset idea also covers businesses that are, for some temporary reason, suffering some hit to their profits. Maybe they're investing in something, or maybe there's a downturn for, you know, like the pandemic is a great example of that. And if we can buy a very big, a very low multiple to normalized profits, then of course, as the profits come back and the multiple grows again, there's two ways for us to make money. And the third, and probably most important at any one time, type of investment is in growth. It's in very good businesses, which obviously a lot of people are looking for, particularly now. And if, I'd say if we have an edge, it's patience in buying, either following a company for an awful long time, it could be many, many years before you invest, or indeed doing the opposite and finding something and then an event happens like the pandemic and investing very quickly and taking advantage of an unusual price for a very good business. And finally, and probably the most important element of patience is, of course, waiting. So we've had a number of businesses, particularly in the European fund, where you see that very, very large outperformance. And a big part of that is because we've had businesses that we owned for 10, 15, 17 years that have turned out to be exceptionally high quality, whose growth has continued, and where we were able to make compounded returns of, say, 15 to 25% per annum, you know, over a long period of time. That can be, as you'll appreciate, that can be exceptionally profitable.
For sure. And jumping in, particularly into a little bit more detail, would you mind telling us about a stock that you like at this point in time, or one that really interests you?
Sure. One of the biggest positions, I think it's now the second largest position in our UK fund, is a business called Naked Wines. I don't know if you've seen any of their advertising, Graham, in the States, but the States is it's a UK business. The States is their biggest market, and they're also very big here in the UK and in Australia. It's a wine merchant, a wine retailer. They used to have shops, but they sold the shops very fortuitously just before the pandemic struck. So they haven't had that problem, because they had the opposite effect. In fact, there's been a massive acceleration of their growth during the pandemic. But they were growing fast before that. This just been a particularly good year for them. It's a wonderful business, apart from it being what I call low touch. In other words, you know, there's not enormous investment in premises or people, or there's IT really, and advertising is their biggest expense. So it's low touch, which is very nice today, but I think is part of the future of many successful businesses. It has a big subscriber base, which you'll appreciate. And some of those subscribers pay up front. So you're buying wine, but if you choose to become a subscriber, you get special discounts. You get access to exclusive growths of wine, and that money is negative working capital. It's cash paid up front, so it's like many subscription businesses, it has that wonderful working capital effect. So it's had cash for a long time, and as it grows, its cash grows faster than its profits, and it's able to use that cash to invest. What does it invest in? In advertising. So looking at this business, it's got a loss-making bit and a profitable bit. The loss-making bit is that they put out vouchers, discounts, so that on your first purchase, you can buy a case of wine at a, you know, an unbelievable price on which Naked Wines will certainly lose money. And then a certain proportion of those initial first-time buyers become subscribers, and that subscription business is the second business, and that's profitable. So if you analyze the businesses into those two parts, as the business is growing very rapidly, the the requirement to invest in the first bit of the business actually gets less and less compared to the value of the second bit of the business. You see, there's a lots of subscription businesses, and at some point it flips. You know, they become profitable overall. So right now, the business as a whole is, the company as a whole is not profitable. But if you take just the subscription part of the business, which has a fairly high, very high recurring element, regular subscribers who carry on past the first year, they make enough from those subscribers to pay off the marketing investment within a year or two. And if you take just the subscription part and take away the cash, we paid probably only about 11 times taxed operating profit. And for a business which should grow about 60% this year, that seems more than a reasonable price, or less than a reasonable price, depending on which way you look at it. So we're already somewhat up on it, but you know, that's a business that we like very much, that we bought quite considerably over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it's hopefully going to pan out over time there. And looking into your process there, finding these investments, what would you say really sets you apart from other types of managers out there?
Let me just share another slide there. So I already mentioned, Graham, patience. I think that, you know, that's a word, but it's a reality. You know, we are able to wait an awful long time. And, you know, most of what we're doing every day is just reading and thinking and not taking any action. So I've mentioned waiting on the buying. I've mentioned waiting on the holding as well. We don't do a lot of selling. What else? We're trying to buy businesses that are lower risk than average. What does lower risk mean? An easy part of the risk calculation is businesses with cash. Not all of our businesses have cash, but most of them do. Businesses with low operating leverage as well. So that in shocks like this, even cash or no cash, they don't suddenly drop into trouble. There are sectors that we generally don't like that much, and they tend quite often to correspond to the ones that the relative value investors might like. So we haven't done anything in energy, for example. And in the UK, if you take out energy, you take out the big banks, you take out the supermarkets, take out the insurance companies, you know, none of which we're in, you've taken out a very substantial part of the total capitalization of the UK and Europe. And that's been fortuitous, would be a nice way of putting it. That, you know, we haven't, you know, the banking sector has been a terrible destroyer of shareholder value for the last 20 years or so. So we just avoided those problems. We're not a very big firm compared to our competition. Our total assets under management are about 35 million pounds. I suppose that's $45 million, something like that. So we still have an opportunity to invest in things that are smaller than average. Some of these liquidations are quite small, for example, and we've got plenty of ideas. So we're sort of really ready to absorb fresh capital and attack some of those ideas.
Definitely. And on that note, at any given time, are you maintaining a certain amount of cash kind of in hand to jump on things if you need to at any given time?
So that's really a byproduct of what ideas there are. But I think it's interesting for the viewers to know that coming into the pandemic, we had a very substantial cash balance. I think we had over 30% cash in each fund. And that was probably a consequence of the very high prices that there were, which we can hardly remember now. But 2 years ago, prices seemed very high. There just wasn't much about. And then when the pandemic hit, we spent almost all of that money. over some months, and but there were things that we've been looking at. I can talk about some of them if you like. There are things that we've been looking at, things that we held that we knew very well, that suddenly became not just affordable, but really intrinsically cheap, very cheap. And so right now we've got less than 10% cash, I suppose.
So in a sense, you were not necessarily well positioned, but well prepared to jump on things kind of once the pandemic struck.
Yeah, it is nice to have cash. It is possible to recycle capital and take things out of ideas that are overvalued. But if you think they're overvalued by absolute means, then you shouldn't be holding them anyway,
Definitely. And when you actually do decide to truly, give a company the time of day, how do you go about valuing that company and deciding that it's really worth that investment?
Well, that's it, isn't it? That's the billion dollar question. That's the whole question in a way. I think I've made clear that we're both fundamentalist and absolutist, by which I mean we're interested in fundamentals, of course, but we're not interested in other people's valuations very much. It's probably obvious to your audience, but other people's valuations are your opportunity. Nevertheless, there's a substantial subjective element to this, because we're almost the only thing we're interested in is the future. The future is where all this value is going to be generated for us, and nobody knows what the future is. So that, by definition, that's a subjective test. And my estimate of future cash flow is almost certainly going to be different from yours, even if you're a value investor as well. I think what you can say, people talk about intrinsic value very much because of the Buffett dominance of the conversation. They talk about margin of safety, but I think that's probably a bit of a trap. I've come to the conclusion, if you focus too much on those concepts and too literally, as I probably did in the book that I wrote at the start of my investing career, it can lead to you playing safe, not in the sense that I've already talked about in having more stable ideas, but you tend to end up buying lower quality things again. You tend to end up looking for the largest apparent discounts. And that discount is only going to manifest itself in the future of the business, which, as I say, by definition, hasn't happened yet. So I think a lot of Buffett followers, Benjamin Graham followers, end up investing in highly predictable businesses, let's say a Heineken or a Coca-Cola type business, which may have had its day in a way, or Unilever, say, in Europe. A business that, Nestle, a business that's perfectly stable, but where there isn't a tremendous amount of difference between even a good price and the ultimate value you might realize. So I think that's not a very precise answer to your question, but it's not a very precise business. I think what we try to do is to look for, if you'll forgive the word, egregious divergences between price and value, by which I mean there's such a like in Naked Wines, how would we value it? I don't know what the value is, but I can say that the opportunity for the business looks like it might be 15 or 20 times the size of the business today, right? And if we're paying only 12 times taxed subscriber operating profits, I don't need a model to say that the potential value of a business that could be 15 or 20 times bigger with all the operating leverage that would bring. So the profits would be, larger proportionately than that. Call that the intrinsic value, just for sake of, I'm not saying this is the value, right? But say that the potential intrinsic value is 15 times larger than the profits show today. That gives you an idea of what ideally what the gap should be between price and valuation. But I don't need to know. I can't know, but I don't need to know exactly what that value is today. I just need to know there's a big enough gap.
Understood.
I hope that's an answer.
For sure. And pulling from one of our audience questions here real quick, on that note, regardless of kind of finding that exact number or having just that general sense of where it could end up, are there any metrics that you regularly look at, or do you try and kind of avoid hitting those exact numbers altogether?
Metrics are a very good way of reducing your opportunity set quickly. Interest cover, say, or if you're looking at individual industries, a metric that's often quoted is price compared to assets under management. So under 2% for a regular fund manager, maybe under 5% for a hedge fund type manager with performance fees. But they do bring dangers, because you're not truly looking at what you're interested in again. Apart from the fact you're looking at history and you want to know what the assets under management will be in 10 years' time, not what they were last year. They're just inherently, maybe lazy is too strong a word, but they're too easy. To give an example, when I was in banking and coming into investing, I remember that people always said that banks would be bought if their price was over 1x book value. That was a fair price. Well, you know, that's pretty soon was 2x book value, and there was no particular reason for it. It just made more sense to the trade buyers, who are almost always the buyers of banks, and still to pay more. Was that sensible? I don't know. You have to look at the circumstances of the individual bank. So if there was any metric I would trust out of all of them, it would be price earnings. Not because I think earnings is always right, it's not, but because you're comparing two numbers that are fairly real. Price is definitely real. You know how many shares are outstanding. You should have an idea how that's going to develop. And earnings, you know, if the accounting is reasonable, and you're not looking at EBITDA, you're not looking at earnings before exceptionals, you're not adding back dilution, all the other things that managers do these days. But if you're really looking at a true tax profit, I think that's a good place to start.
Understood. And it seems like there's kind of, we'll call them boundless horizons at this point for you, with that long-term investment horizon and seeking out kind of those differentiated opportunities there. At any point, have you made a mistake or had something kind of come back to bite you? And what have you learned from it?
Well, you do make mistakes very often. I can't say it's inevitable, but I don't imagine there are many investors who haven't made mistakes, if a mistake is defined as loss of capital. So certainly I've made lots of mistakes in my investing career. The sort of mistake that you're interested in probably is the one that you can learn from. And losing money isn't necessarily the best guide to what you should do next, because if you're looking at a portfolio of 10 similar investments and 3 lose you money, same as a venture capitalist, if 7 of them are making money, you might do exceptionally well, you know, if they're making 10 times the money. So that's the sort of mistake that I think is dangerous to learn from. A mistake that we made this year that I think is more during the pandemic that I think is more illuminating is buying businesses of the sort that I was talking about in the last answer, say businesses that are too safe, that look cheap and were cheap, but the upside just wasn't big enough. So, in the depths of the pandemic, we bought a business called Mercia, which was a combination of different things, but it was mainly an asset manager. And using any of the criteria that I mentioned already, profits, price compared to assets under management, enterprise values, profits, and so on, it was certainly cheap. I think the mistake was that there just wasn't enough fizz or buzz or excitement or growth or zoom non-trademark Zoom in the business. And so we sold it and, you know, bought Naked Wine, some other businesses that were much, much better value. So that, you know, this idea that I already mentioned in the context of Naked Wines, that you want a very large, a very egregious distance between what the value might turn out to be and what you pay is very important. And if you play it too safe, then you are making a mistake because you're tying up your capital. And for us, probably a very substantial part of our capital, since we're fairly concentrated in something that just won't perform for you.
Gotcha. And jumping in now, obviously that's that was a relatively recent example there. Are there any other stocks that you bought more recently or in the last couple of months here that you're excited about or been doing well?
Yeah, there's something I bought just in the last week that obviously I'm excited about. I'm at that stage of infatuation, you know, where we're at, like, the first date. But it's a business probably I've followed about for about a year or two. And it's unusual. I think it's interesting just to spend a few minutes on it, if you don't mind, in that it's slightly different from the others. It's probably more what I would call a hidden value. I mentioned hidden value already, but it's a good illustration of, if you dig enough, you can find a value. So it's a small business, very small business, only about £70 million market cap. So it wasn't easy to buy the shares, but it's liquid enough for us. It's called Morse's Club. Morse's Club, M-O-R-S-E-S. So the ticker's MCL, to quote it in London. And it's also a fairly young company. It's a main business is doorstep lending, which say it makes fairly high interest loans, largely by going door to door. I don't mean they knock on the door and say, "Do you want money?" But, you know, they advertise to people and they collect the money. So it's a very old fashioned sort of business, and you could say just about the worst designed business for the pandemic, because lending is difficult anyway. Because lending became even more highly regulated during the pandemic here. The regulator, you know, put in certain curbs on how much you could collect and froze some of the lending collection activities. And, of course, going door to door was impossible, is impossible. We're in another big lockdown here again in the UK. And so the good news, I suppose, from our point of view, is that meant the share price collapse. The share price dropped by, it wasn't particularly highly valued to start with, a small lender, but the share price went down by 60%, and then it starts to get interesting. The other thing you have to understand about this business, Graham, is that once you look at it, you see, again, it's not making an awful amount of money, but it turns out to have two businesses. So a bit like I split Naked Wines into the ongoing business and the offer business, the discounted voucher business. In this case, they've got their doorstep lending business, and like a number of lenders, they've bought and invested in an online lending business, okay, which is the future as we now understand it. And as they've invested in it, it's lost money, okay? But the company is highly confident from their public statements that this business will come into profit fairly soon, within the next year or two. And so, and you've also had some fallback in the existing business. So it's all a bit of a mess. But using some fairly simple assumptions, and these are the assumptions, that A, the digital business will at least break even, at worst break even, and B, that the core business, the existing doorstep lending business, will come back to its normal level of profitability. It's had exceptional provisions because of the pandemic. It's had a reduction in its lending book. But I don't think these are heroic assumptions at all. You have a business that provably is making about £22 million after tax. So we've paid, by paying the price that we've paid just over 3x earnings for that core business. If the digital business, of course, becomes wildly profitable, then that's an option, or a free option, you might say. But even if it doesn't, we've got this margin of safety, And the margin of safety here comes from the price. The price is very low. And the upside, you know, could be 3 to 6 times. A question that you might ask, given everything I've said, is it, you know, isn't it terribly risky? The reason why we haven't, generally speaking, bought banks is that they tend to be very risky in themselves, not because they're lenders, but because they're borrowers. You know, if you're buying a bank in the States, you maybe got 20 times leverage. If you're buying a UK bank, maybe 50 times leverage at this stage because of the weakness of their capital position. And this business has about net debt, about £7 million and net tangible assets of about £50 million. So it really is not in the same league at all. And there's next to no downside risk in it. That's touch words, you know, famous last words. But the downside risk that you might associate with a lender is just not there. Whereas the upside is what I've already described.
Gotcha. Well, does seem like another good opportunity there. So we'll hopefully see it pan out for you. At this point in time, we can go ahead and jump into some questions here from our audience. First one, right off the top, could a viewer wondering how they could start in some low frame investing, if you have any recommendations there.
To start into what sort of investing, sorry?
In low frame investing.
I'm not sure I know what low frame investing is. Do you know what it is?
I was hoping you would have the answer there for me. we'll see if we can.
While we answer the next question, I'm going to look it up.
Definitely. And we can go into the next one, which I think should operate in your wheelhouse a little better there. Regarding UK companies in comparison to US companies, don't submit the same quarterly statements to the SEC. So where do you, I guess, search for kind of those similar quarterly reports or earning reports, things like that? And how do you go about finding that type of information?
Okay, so I've Googled low frame investing and I can't find anything. So if that person is listening, could they just maybe go back into the chat and tell us what they mean? And I'm, you know, happy to answer if I can. Yeah, absolutely. UK companies usually report formal results twice a year, although they very, very often supplemented by what are called trading statements. So in fact, on average, they probably are reporting 4 or 5 times a year. So I don't think there's a great difference. The trading statements won't be as detailed as the quarterly statements you get to the SEC. And European companies tend to report somewhere in between, so it's a quarterly statement, but the quarterly statement might have a bit less detail. But to answer the more implied point as to, you know, whether that's a less safe situation, I don't think so. I mean, frankly, when I look at a company, I look back over the whole history that I can find. So that might be 20 years or more. So the progress of the company in any one quarter is not that relevant. Generally, in times like these where things are happening very fast, of course, you want to know, you know, is the company collecting its rents, or, you know, have all of its customers gone bust? But I'm at no comparative disadvantage to any other investor if they're not telling us that. So I don't think that should, in my opinion, that should really stop people investing in things, or indeed stop people investing in the UK. To answer your other question, how do we get our ideas? Well, personally, I read as much as I can. So I will read almost every UK company's announced results on the day they come out, just to obviously keep up to date with things that we're invested in or we're following, but also to look for new ideas. So I'm looking at, I won't say hundreds, but tens and tens of company statements every day. And then when I finish that exciting breakfast job, you know, I'll go back and look for some other things, because that's what I enjoy doing. So getting ideas, I think when I started off, I would have used screeners and looked at other people's portfolios, which I still do look at other people's portfolios, exchange ideas with friends who are managers. But generally, I'm just poking around across the stock markets of Europe like an old-fashioned tourist on the grand tour, looking for interesting ideas. Sometimes I like industries. I like asset management, for example. I think that's a very good industry if it's well managed. And so I'll look at all the asset managers, or if I've decided that I might, you know, the property companies are very cheap, as they are from time to time, I'll look at all the property companies in a particular country. It's not as many as it sounds, you know, it might only be 20 or 30 in any given market. And, you know, you get fairly fast at saying no to things and then reducing the opportunity set down to the few that look worth following. Then I add them to a watch list, like I'm sure most people do, and then I'll just be following them for as long as it takes for me either to become familiar enough or for the price to become exciting enough to actually do something.
Definitely. So it sounds like there's a little bit of structure there, but not overly structured by any means.
Sure.
And jumping over now, we did answer the next question already, but got a viewer here looking to get your thoughts on any of the cruise companies at this time. Any feelings or stance there on whether it would be an opportunity or not at all?
Yeah, so if you think of the cruise ships as hotels with the opportunity of dying at sea, you know, from any means, there are lots of ways you can die at sea these days. Watery hotels, if that's too poor taste. They haven't tended to be good investments. I did, you know, when I first started looking at all industries 20 years ago, look at the cruise companies, the Carnivals and so on. There's not many of them. They've always had, unless I've missed out on what, you know, I haven't gone back to that industry. They've always had low returns on capital, fairly high leverage, both debt and you know, the inherent operating leverage of very big capital investment type businesses. So like hotels and restaurants, unless there's a particular one that the viewer is interested in that I could look at, is probably not an area that is going to be that exciting. Just to segue that into a short word on airlines, which you'd think would be in the same boat. That was unintentional. That's true. Airlines have many of the same characteristics, but there are, you know, one or two really excellent airline companies that I would look at if I were the viewer rather than the cruise ship companies. Spirit in America, Wizz Air, which is actually based in Hungary but is quoted here in London, and although it's probably a less exciting company now, Ryanair is one of the companies we held probably for 15 years, and there are, you know, one or two others, but there are low-cost airlines that have done particularly well. But there isn't a similar concept in the cruise ship world. It's not to say it's not possible. One could imagine if one were designing a good investment in the cruise ship industry, maybe a franchise company or the agency company, or if they split the ownership of the cruise ships into a REIT or something, if that was legally possible, and put the management contracts into another company, maybe that could work. But I haven't seen it actually happen.
Understood. And I'll ask the generalized question of this first. Any thoughts on shorting companies? Question here specifically regarding some of the high flyers and EV stocks and tech recently.
Well, you need very strong guts, wouldn't you, to to take that bet. A friend of mine shorted Tesla, but fortunately he closed it before it all went a bit crazy. Let me answer that in two parts, because that's a specific sector call and there's a shorting. Well, I don't short. We have the legal ability to do it in the fund, but we've never done it. It is about guts. It is about having a good night's sleep. It's not a proven source of alpha or, you know, returns. Even the most vaunted short sellers in the world have really not made very much money over time, and they sort of remarket themselves, I guess, as providing a hedge. And, you know, maybe that's sensible for somebody who needs a hedge. I don't feel that we need a hedge. Our hedge is cash. hedges the quality of the businesses that we're investing in that should carry on and grow and take opportunity even in downturns like this. So I don't feel I need to short, and I don't feel I'd be good at it either. It's very, very difficult. As to the these new wave of technology companies of the type that we're now on, like Zoom, and you and I are speaking over anyway, so other people on YouTube. Well, that's a good contrast between Zoom and Alphabet, which is the owner of YouTube. So Alphabet is a very well-established business with several extremely profitable lines of business: YouTube, the core advertising business, and so on. Those are probably the biggest, but they're both excellent businesses. Whereas Zoom, and certainly this new wave of IPOs of businesses in enterprise software, say, or software that enables enterprise software, or software that enables the software that enables the enterprise software, difficult to sometimes to understand exactly what the business is, because that makes it extremely difficult to value. And secondly, they've often been loss-making businesses. And thirdly, the valuations are already, by any normal standards, exceptionally high. So I'm certainly not investing in that field for those reasons, and I'm not shorting it either. And often in life, it's easy just to stay away. Just because something is not a good long doesn't mean it's a good short.
Gotcha. And this is a question that we've had come up recently, most recently actually last week in our member engagement meeting run by our founder Charlie. Do you foresee a bubble coming in 2021?
Well, I would say that those businesses that we've just been alluding to, among which you might include Zoom. Zoom is a profitable company. How good its barrier is to competitors, I couldn't say. It is amazing how barriers have emerged even on some fairly competitive markets, like cloud computing seems to have some barrier in it, even though there are a number of big players. The Dropbox type business seems to. So I wouldn't bet anything on the short side again, but it does feel in these businesses like the one that I was, you know, vaguely trying to describe, this enterprise software type of company, the sort of company that is being priced on its sales only, shall we say that? There's certainly some winners there, but it seems like a lot of companies are coming to market at a stage far earlier than they would have done otherwise, with massive losses. I will throw in, for the sake of the conversation and to give people something to think about, you know, it's not impossible. It's difficult to see how a business like Uber, for example, will become profitable. We've got a competitor business here, Deliveroo, that has it's apparently, just based on what I read, has a negative gross margin, which is a mind-blowing concept. In other words, it's losing money on each delivery, let alone, you know, without taking into account its own core overhead. Airbnb, I haven't seen the numbers of yet, but some of these businesses are not that scalable, particularly the ones with very substantial capital expenditure. Again, one saw it in that, what was it called, that SoftBank business that got into awful trouble before the pandemic, the landlord business. It didn't look particularly scalable, very capital intensive. And so I think I don't think it's possible actually to say whether there's a bubble in anything until the bubble is popped, just as a technical concept. I just think that's very difficult to say. But if you wanted to look for overvaluation, that would be where I would look for it. Yeah,
definitely. And looking down our list here, do you do any options at all in your investment strategy?
No. So we try and keep it very, very simple to keep the risk down. So we don't short, as I've already said. We don't leverage, perhaps I should have said that. We don't have any derivatives of any kind. I mean, we would look at hedging currency if we had to for our shareholders, but that's a different sort of derivative, I suppose. And so we haven't bought any options. We certainly haven't written any options, and we don't have any derivative risk at all. We're trying to keep it as low risk as possible and as pleasant a ride as possible for our clients.
Definitely. And curiosity from one of our viewers, looking out into some more worldwide or potentially emerging markets, any thoughts on Africa in general, companies starting to come to market there, anything like that?
I have thoughts on Africa. They haven't reached as far as any particular investment ideas, I'm afraid. And my thoughts on Africa are probably not that original, but it is not the Africa of our childhood, of my childhood, not the Africa of our grandparents' generation. It's a continent that has, you know, improved its lot for one reason or another, more dramatically than any other in the last 20 years, because of more education among women, the entry of women into the workplace, to some extent good governance post decolonialization, and all the problems that brought, less disease, of course, and thanks to Bill Gates, you know, for that. So it's a healthier continent than it was, and therefore through the combination of all of these things and technology as well, its standard of living, the standard of living of the average African person, has really shot up in our recent lifetimes. And so I'm sure it's a continent where there are opportunities and will be opportunities, but unfortunately I'm not the person to ask about them. I'm not investing there.
For sure. And looking down our list here, question coming off of a tail end of another question earlier. Any thoughts on the Fever Tree Beverage Company, if you have any experience there?
So as you probably gathered by now, you know, I'm familiar with a large number of companies in the UK and in Europe, including Fever Tree. So it's the one that I keep an eye on because it's very high growth. It's, you know, it seems like a good business. It's had some problems in the last year in its channels and launching in America, and I'm sort of vaguely, I've read enough to be vaguely caught up on what's going on. Because the valuation has always appeared so high, it's not something I've really bothered with. Again, it's just put into the too difficult pile. It's a company I can imagine that we would own at some point because it seems to be a good business. But it's so often difficult to tell with these businesses that are doing exceptionally well how much of a you know, up with a rocket and down with a stick sort of business it could be. If you think of a business like I can't remember what it's called, but I think it's an Irish company called C&C that did very well in cider and in Perry, which is a similar drink to cider. And it seemed very similar to me. You know, it was doing very, very well for a decade because its cider brands were exciting to young people who like getting drunk very cheaply. I suppose is why you drink cider. It's probably what I did when I was 18 or 19. And then suddenly it wasn't very exciting. Magners, I think, was one of the brands, possibly. And suddenly it wasn't very exciting. Burberry's was another. You know, these are not retail businesses. These are product businesses that are very fashionable for a time. But if you've got one brand, in Europe, for example, we own two high fashion companies that you'll know, one called Louis Vuitton and one called Kering. Kering owns Gucci. And, you know, these businesses are fairly, although they're quite identified with one brand, they're actually quite diversified in their product ranges and in their brand ownership. And, you know, this has proven to be a winning formula over the last 20 or 30 years. We've probably owned Louis Vuitton for 15 years or so. And it just does better and better as people in Africa, but even more so in China and in India and so on, become wealthier than the rest of Asia. And that is quite a simple thing to understand. And from time to time, they've been quite cheap. From time to time, you could buy them at 12 or 13 times earnings, which is very good for the sort of growth that's represented there. Whereas if you look at a business like Fevertree, and I couldn't tell you the exact numbers, but you know, probably its PE in the last 5 years hasn't been lower than 30 or 28 times, something like that. That's a much different bet. And so it just hasn't come into my range of possibility yet.
Understood. And kind of compounding on that question, for these companies that have high potential or are currently successful and could kind of explode moving into the future, if you were to decide you truly wanted to get involved in one of them, how do you make sure that you don't pay an overly high price for these companies?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose one doesn't know whether one's paid a high price until the future manifests itself, but that's not a very satisfying answer to the question. One way you can do it, let me shoot another few quick examples of things that we bought this year. We bought a number of businesses that had massive amounts of cash. Now, having a massive amount of cash, so long as you're prepared to use it at some point, either to return it to shareholders or buy something with it or invest in your own business, is very good. It's good because it reduces the valuation of the business. You're paying for a business and a pile of cash. So we bought two employment agency businesses in the pandemic, Robert Walters, the UK company, and a French company called Synergie, S-Y-N-E-R-G-I-E, both with, I'd say, off the top of my head, but both with getting on for half of their market cap in cash. So that reduces the overall investment risk, and it reduces the possibility of a downside. But it can mean that the business is being grossly undervalued as well. And in fact, if you took off the cash in both of those cases when we bought them, in the last 6 months, we were paying of the order of 3 to 4 times tax operating profits. So not EBITDA, not EBIT, no funny business. Take the operating profit, so you're ignoring the effect of the interest from the cash, and tax it at the proper tax rate. And we were paying tiny, tiny amounts for the business. So how do you know you're not paying too much? That's one way. If you find a business where the cash is really being ignored by the stock market and the owners are not ridiculous, they're not going to spend the cash on fast cars and big salaries, which in both these cases we knew they weren't, because they've been going for 30 years and they're both controlled by the founders, as it happens. Quite nice to have founder controlled businesses. That's one of the reasons. So we knew they were going to do sensible things, probably buy competitors at some point. Otherwise, my answer's got to be very generic. How do you know that's what you're paid for if you're in the investment management business? Well, that's what you should be aiming for if you're an investor yourself, is precisely to have a range of possibilities of what the business might be worth, and to pay under that range if you can. If you can pay way under that range, then whether you're partly right or very right, you will make money.
Gotcha. And now that we've exhausted, we'll say in a sense, the topic of buying companies, just to kind of round things out here as we're getting up towards our time limit here, when do you actually go and sell a company, or if ever in that case?
You sell if you're wrong, you've made a mistake. You sell, secondly, if, like the case that I mentioned earlier, the Mercier was the name of the business, that the growth doesn't manifest, or you it's just not performing. So it's not actually, you haven't made a mistake, it just doesn't turn out to be as exciting as you thought. But just to turn the question on its head, I would say one of the biggest mistakes that I've made consistently, and particularly in the last year or two, is selling too quickly. And so one answer to your question is, when should you sell, is a bit more slowly than you otherwise might do, because quite often that business, that you get worried because it's gone up to a PE of 30, say. If it's a very good business, maybe you shouldn't worry too much about that. There will be some downside risk because maybe it will be re-rated downwards or whatever. But if it's a great business, then probably you shouldn't sell it.
Definitely. Well, that's going to wrap up all of our questions today. For those of you out in the audience, if you missed any part of the presentation or you want to tune back in, look back over things, take a peek at those slides, by all means, there will be a full recording posted here on our YouTube channel, as well as on GuruFocus.com. And I want to pass over my thanks to Richard for taking the time to come out and sit down with us and answer these questions from the audience. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Graham. I really enjoyed it.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on GuruFocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of GuruFocus where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again and we'll see you next time.